Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Vasilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Your last name is Bozo, right? Is that how you say it?
It's actually Bozo.
Bozo. Okay, that's what I thought. Okay.
It kind of sounds like French, but it's actually a very old Hungarian name, and everybody thinks in Europe that I'm French, but they're not.
So Peter Bozo.
Exactly.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Okay. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 255, being recorded on the 14th of November, 2018, with special guest Peter Bozo. I'm Sajid, and on Skype with me, I have almost a full house, actually. We've got Russell, we've got Evan, Kendall, and of course our special guest Peter, who we'll get to in just a minute. Oh, I think Cynthia and Kayla also on. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. So full house. Let's see. Let's get started with some of the updates in the Azure space. Anybody have any favorites they'd like to start with?
I can't. This is Evan. I can't miss the SQL stuff. This was actually I was not aware that we were doing this work. And this was, I think, actually a really cool integration. So if you know SQL Server, you know that you can do dynamic management view queries, right? Which are kind of real-time things that'll tell you what your wait stats are, what your queries are, the number of requests that are running concurrently, all the stuff that helps you do performance tuning and other management of your SQL Server. The SQL Server Data Warehouse has similar capabilities. And what we've done is we've integrated that with Azure Monitor. So now that information gets dumped into Azure Monitor as well. So it used to be you would have to connect to your SQL Server instance, connect to your SQL Data Warehouse instance to run these queries. Now you're actually able to plug into the Azure Log Analytics and the Azure Monitor streams and get the same information. So I think that's super, super cool. And that's really one of the, I guess, good examples of where we're going, which is more and more stuff is going to surface in Azure Monitor and Azure Log Analytics, so that you have this kind of one-stop shopping for all of your telemetry.
Right. And the nice part about that is, and now that can just be fed to downstream systems, CM systems,
or to whatever. Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At
that's
point.
That's a cool thing about that. Very nice. Excellent. How about anybody else?
Yeah, so I've got one. The general availability of Azure Event Hubs for Apache Kafka. Those of you that know what Kafka is, it's a similar service to what Event Hubs does in terms of the functionality that they offer. They're about processing streams of data, so very good for real-time analytics and querying streams on the fly. They're both built for handling large volumes of data in real time. They do partitioning and scale and so on. The difference between the two is that Apache Kafka is an open source offering that's been around for some time. With a different API, whereas Azure Event Hubs was built as a cloud native service on top of Azure, so built cloud ready, and obviously it's got a different API from the one on Kafka. What's nice about this announcement and what they've done is they've allowed you now to just change the connection string on your Kafka application to be able to talk directly into Azure Event Hubs now. So a bit similar to what we did with Cosmos DB some time ago. By implementing third-party open-source APIs, it just allows you to switch to using Azure Event Hubs on the back end instead of Kafka, which gives you all that nice benefit of not having to manage infrastructure, not having to run things like Zookeeper, which looks after the cluster, and all that management overhead that you have on the back end. So that's quite a nice little service that's gone GA.
So they did like a protocol-level thing like they did with the other... With Cosmos, so they just handled it at the protocol level. Is that what they've done?
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Great. Let's see. How about Cynthia? I think you put in something. Did you want to mention?
Yes, I actually just put in something. I was looking through the Sprint update for Azure DevOps. There's actually a lot of new features that came out with this update, and something I want to point the listeners to that I thought would be really helpful is that now some of the features include you can actually draft a pull request now. So what that means is that you're able to add in specific reviewers and whether or not you want to do a build verification before you actually do the pull request. So you can kind of check it through there and you can cancel it if you like. Now you're also able to set for the release pipelines to automatically redeploy if there's a failure. And on the Azure Artifact side, you're now able to exclude certain facts when you're, exclude certain files when you're uploading the artifact, which makes it really helpful because actually in a bot deployment use case, the project I'm working with, the customer, we're actually using the same bot code, but we're using a different bot configuration file. But because we're deploying the entire bot code, that configuration file always gets deployed. But with that, now we're able to exclude it and only deploy the main code and then deploy a specific configuration file. And just a lot of new information for the new sprint. So people that are interested in Azure DevOps, definitely check it out.
Excellent. That sounds like a good firsthand update over there. So I saw this one, which I'd like to talk about, which is regarding Azure Cognitive Services. And it's now, the problem with that with Cognitive Services is that it runs in Azure, right? So if you're a customer that wants to take advantage of it, you have to send your data stream or whatever it is that you're analyzing, text or video, audio stream. You got to send it to Azure and they get processed there and then you get the results back. And for some industries, like that's for example, the medical industry, that's a little bit of a problem. They're very sensitive about sending any kind of sensitive information outside of their data center. And so now what they've done is they've created Azure Cognitive Services in containers. So they give you this container that you can run on your in your own data center. And that container would do the same thing that it would do in the cloud. It would run on your services, on your servers. And this way, the data would remain completely within your data center. So there's less of a concern. I think that's it's a nice feature enhancement for Cognitive Services. The same APIs that you love, you're just going to deploy them completely inside of your data center.
So that, I guess, lets you work offline as well. So where you've got latency issues or connectivity issues, you can do stuff now just as you would have done with the cloud. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You could run them in the the IoT edge scenario gets ramped up with this.
Yeah, I actually saw along with that update, a lot of the use case scenarios really focus on like ships and oil rigs and places where there is limited connectivity. So I think this is awesome, just bringing the power of cognitive services to where the data actually is. I think it's so powerful. I'm really exciting about, just to hear this update.
Yep. Excellent.
I had two this scale. Obviously, the blockchain, we have to do the update for that. So a blockchain workbench shipped 1.5. So the team has put something out that makes it a bit easier. It focused mainly on making it easier to start these deployments. One of the big things is you have to do some configuration with Azure AD. Anyone who's deployed Workbench before knows you have to go into your tenant and kind of configure some stuff, and then you can deploy the solution. This streamlines that a bit, but still leaves all those knobs and dials there for people who want to tweak everything. So we call them more advanced users, and then we just make it streamlined for folks who don't want to kind of get in the weeds with some of that stuff. We also put out some more documentation about troubleshooting and things like that as you start working with this tool set and, run into any bumps or anything from particularly around blockchain when you're doing transactions and things. If you start running into some exceptions or whatnot, how to deal with them. And this is just based on feedback that we've been getting through support forums and different things like that. So it's a great release. Go check it out. We're putting our release notes on GitHub now, too, so you can check them out there. And that's pretty cool update. And the other one I wanted to talk about was non-blockchain related, but kind of. So the holiday season is DDoS season. I thought that was a great headline, but basically it's talking about the some of the telemetry that has come back over the years about, you know, when DDoS attacks ramp up, and we're kind of in that time right now. And walking through some of the things that Azure's been adding as features for virtual networks and things like that that you can actually toggle on. So it kind of walks you through some of those, as well as some of the stuff in OMS to kind of mitigate against any of these kind of attacks that happen during these busy periods.
Yeah, that's a good one, Kaylee. I saw that update. I think everyone needs to worry about DDoS. Certainly something, especially during the holidays. Any more updates that we'd want to talk about before we turn the mic over to our special guests?
I just had a quick one. The custom vision service is now actually adding logo support so that organizations and companies can better basically spot their logo in specifically in situations where maybe it's kind of buried within an image or within a video stream. So I think this is a really neat addition, because this can really play on the social media aspect and pulling out analytics for how often your logo is being featured in different social media posts, etc. So thought that was a cool cognitive services somewhat related update to share.
Yep. Yeah, I heard about a strange use case with this. So there was something about when you're broadcasting media, you're not allowed to do so much product placement before or after an advert of your same product comes out. So there was a company was using it for doing that kind of analysis to make sure that their product didn't appear in any of the programs they were broadcasting if they had an advert scheduled to go out before or after. Quite interesting.
They're watching basically instead of watching the ad, they're watching the show to make sure that their products that they're going to do the ad for are not in the show, right? Like, not the other way around.
Yeah, that's cool, that's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we did have one more update, but that's related to our topic today with regard to creating a branded virtual assistant. So we'll maybe defer that to later. So let's turn the mic over to our special guest, Peter. Peter, please, thank you for joining us today. And go ahead, introduce yourself. Tell us what you do at Microsoft and what you're passionate about in the Azure space. And then we'll take it from there.
Thank you, Sujit. Thank you very much for having me. So I'm Peter Bojol, and I'm a consultant working for Microsoft for a little bit more than 2 years now. I'm based in Hungary. And before joining Microsoft, I was already working with Microsoft technologies. So actually, I started with Windows Phone development, Windows Phone 8.0. Yes, that was the first version.
I remember that.
yeah. Actually, it was a pretty good developer
experience.
It's a great
product. Yeah, it's a great. I've developed apps for it. It's a great environment.
Absolutely. So from that, I moved as the platform evolved. So to 8.1 UWP. Then I dabbled a little bit with Xamarin, and then I basically joined Microsoft. And since then. Yeah, so almost for the last 2 years, I cannot say exclusively working with chatbots, because I guess you guys all know, if you work with Azure, you cannot really say that I'm working exclusively with this or that product. It's just impossible not to touch and not to want to touch any other services, right?
Yep.
So yeah, chatbots all the way. Yeah, absolutely.
So I've heard the term chatbot often, right? And it means, I don't know, I guess people may not be clear about what exactly it means. Maybe can you just give us like a very high level as to what is your definition of a chatbot? How do you see it, especially when you talk to customers about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very good question, actually. And one of the questions that always comes up with customers. So if I go on site and we start to talk about chatbots, it's always the first question, basically, what are chatbots actually, either from a developer point of view or from a more of a business person point of view. And from a developer point of view, what I always say that chatbots on the very basic level are just web applications, really, truly, just web applications. Most of the time, ASP.NET web applications, or now you can write them in with the Microsoft stack in JavaScript, Python, Java. We have SDKs for all of those. So it's basically just a web application. And in context of that web application, you as a developer using this specific bot builder SDK that Microsoft is building actually as an open source SDK, it's all on GitHub. So you can actually participate in the development as well. I think that's incredible value for the community and for Microsoft as well, because we have the power of many eyeballs there. And yeah, so from a developer point of view, it's basically a web application which is interfacing with a lot of cognitive services, which you guys already mentioned in this recording, like Louis, that's the must-have cognitive service, the language understanding intelligence service, which is basically a natural language processing service. Or we have the Q&A maker, that's a very, very nice, very useful tool as well for as it names imply, question and answer scenarios, and many others. So if you are familiar with the cognitive services, I just before this recording, I just opened the cognitive services directory, the website, and yeah, already like three new services, which I never even heard about. So it's like developing at lightning speed. We have new features all the time. It's a challenge to keep up with it, just the cognitive services themselves.
Right. So yeah. So when you say web application, is it just like you know, just HTML basically that it's spitting out? What exactly is the user interface like in these scenarios?
You can think about it like a web application that is communicating in text, basically not in HTML files, not in JavaScript files, but it's basically a web service. So web API, if you are familiar with ASP.NET, it's an ASP.NET web API, and you are not returning HTML files, but you are interfacing with the Microsoft Bot service, which is a service hosted by Microsoft on Azure. And your chatbot is basically talking to that service. And the responsibility of that service is to push your messages, route your messages basically to the appropriate platform. So you, let's say you have a chatbot, which is one code base. And this is, in my opinion, an awesome feat of the Microsoft Bot framework, that you develop one chatbot, you connect it to the Microsoft Bot service, and the bot service is taking care of the interfacing with all the different channels. So let's say you can have the very same chatbot, the very same functionality, everything is the same on Skype or Microsoft Teams, Slack, Facebook Messenger, and you are only maintaining and developing one code base and not specific to each channel. Of course, if you would like to, you can develop certain functionalities that are dedicated to so to say a channel, let's say on Facebook Messenger, you can have a very nice UI requesting the location of the user, which is not available in other channels. You can do that, but you don't need to. So it's a very great feature in my opinion.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah,
I was gonna say, I mean, that's awesome that you can kind of deploy once and use in all these different scenarios. Is it typical to do it that way, or is it typical to do different ones? I guess historically you always did different ones for each service, but is it pretty typical that people will do one code base for everything, or is there really a lot of variability between these? I just don't know enough about the other chat environments.
Mm-hmm. It depends really a lot on your, let's say, on your or your customer or the specific use case that you are developing the chatbot for. So for example, we had a customer who created a Facebook, so it was one chatbot, as I said, and they published it on Facebook, and they also published it on their own website. So when you navigated to their website, it just came up as a bubble on the bottom right corner, and you can chat with the very same, and you would get the very same logic, the very same functionalities there as well. Yeah, but it's not unheard of to have completely separate chatbots on completely separate channels. It really depends on the use case.
Okay.
So I want to make sure I understand that flow properly, because you threw in a whole bunch of other things like Slack, Skype, and Facebook Messenger and whatnot, right? So let's assume you're using Skype. What is the flow from Skype? Where does it go? Does it go to your chatbot first, and then over to the cognitive service, to the bot service, or is it the other way around?
You can think about it. Usually chatbot. So the web application which I was mentioning, the web API. Let's talk with ASP.NET. You have an ASP.NET web API, mm-hmm. which is your chatbot, and usually it works like. When a user comes to your chatbot, let's say, to stick to the example, to Skype, he adds the chatbot as a friend on Skype, like any other user. It will be just another user in his Skype directory.
Okay.
Sends a message to the bot on Skype. It will be sent to the Microsoft bot service, and the bot service will send it to the Microsoft chatbot that you are developing. So that's your own application. And inside your own application, you can, as you have a web application, you are absolutely free to call any kind of services. So let's say the cognitive services, or let's say you have a internal ticketing system, let's say that, and you would like to make it possible to create a support ticket via mm-hmm. your chatbot. And you can do that with your application because it's, again, just an application. You can call any kind of API that you would like to.
Got it. I understood now. Okay, so the flow makes sense. It starts from the user endpoint, whatever the application they're using, Slack, connects to the Microsoft bot service, which talks to your endpoint at the on the chatbot application, and then you can do whatever you want.
Exactly. And the other way around, of course, your chatbot is talking to the service is routing it to the appropriate user on the appropriate channel.
Okay, for sending the responses back, yeah.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, if you think about it, that kind of makes sense, because I think there's obviously complexity calling your own APIs, but the service, it sounds like, is really trying to sit in the middle so that you only, I think, Peter, to what you were saying earlier, right, you only have to write your code for this one API, and then the bot service itself figures out how to translate that to, you know, Facebook's API, which is probably just a little bit different than the Skype one, which is a little bit different from Teams. You don't have to worry about that. The service takes care of that for you. It's an interface, basically.
Exactly. If you, for example, familiar with, let's say, Xamarin or React Native, this is what I usually compare it to, because it's a similar. The goal is similar: developing one code base and reaching multiple users on multiple channels, just different technologies.
So I have a question for you. When it comes to managing the expectations when we're building a chatbot, how do we manage the expectation of what they can actually achieve and how human-like they can become without kind of overstating their use case? So what do you see typically when it comes to, let me explain how this can be useful without overstating what's possible. Does that make sense?
Yes, I see your point. And it's your question is really complex. I usually talk about like an hour about this topic to my customers, but to keep it short, it's very, very important in my personal opinion and from my professional experience that you make it clear to the user that they are, tell me if I'm not answering your question, but it's very important to make it clear to the user that they are talking to a chatbot, that they are it's not a real person who they are talking to, because it immediately sets the expectations. You immediately have a feel for, okay, what can I do? And it's also very, very useful to do, for example, what we usually do in a chatbot development project is that we don't start a full-blown API solution. So we don't start with, not with Louis. So we are not even trying to recognize the text with AI immediately, but we start with, in a lot of these messaging channels, all of them actually have buttons, for example. So what you do usually, you make a very simple flow, like really like an application, like a mobile application. Just instead of pages, you would have messages, but you would have the same buttons, or you are sending pictures to the user. So you are making it as easy to use as possible. And then based on the usage that you see from the users, which can be tracked, for example, with application insights, that's what we usually use in this project, you can actually measure what the users must use, what are their favorite features based on this, so to say, stupid bot. It's not stupid, it's just not as smart as it would have AI.
And I love that, Peter.
Right? You need to educate your users. That's the challenge here, because chatbots are really new, a really new technology, not from just from the customer point of view, but from the end user point of view. So people not always know what they can do with these chatbots. And you need to make your chatbot grow with your audience. You see what I mean? You start with a, so to say, stupid chatbot. And as the users are getting more comfortable with using it, you are infusing it with AI. So you identify the parts which are the most interesting for the users and try to make them smoother, easier to access with AI, like handling freeform text messages from the user, not just pushing buttons, but you can actually tell the chatbot, okay, I would like to order a pizza or something like that. And then your chatbot would immediately understand it. I hope I answered your question here.
Yeah, you did. And how much of the training within chatbots can be automated? How much of that learning experience are we really leveraging to then have the model basically train itself? Is that something that we've gotten to at Microsoft where we are able to say, okay, based on the user's response, we can actually train the bot, its own model can be training simultaneously with this input? Or is that still something that's done more retroactively by developers?
It's almost always supervised learning. So we are experimenting with, self-learning chatbots. But usually it works like that. Let's say, I'm giving you an example. That's the easiest one to understand the situation. Let's say we have a customer who have a big customer service department with real customer agents who are answering the actual questions. Then we deploy a chatbot there, and we actively involve the actual customer agents who are working with the customers before deploying the chatbot about how to set up the chatbot, how to make the first, let's say, two or three flows of the chatbot, because they are the persons who are actually in possession of the knowledge what are their customers usually ask from them, so they know what would be the most important for them. And then while we are developing the chatbot as an ongoing training, basically we are also involving them in that as well. So let's say we have Louis, and in Louis you can train the AI. Louis is basically, as all of our cognitive services are, like, I always call them AI as a service. It's kind of like a black box to the developer, so you don't actually know what is the algorithm, for example, used in the language detection or the text recognition. But you can train the model with your own with the actual user's inputs, but you need to supervise that. So you need some persons who are actually looking through the messages that the users are sending to the chatbot and deciding, okay, here the user meant this, the user meant that, and then you train your AI model based on that. And usually this is where we involve the employees of the customer, actually, so to make it as good as possible. But it's in my opinion, it's far from being totally automated. And I don't see it in the near future to become fully automated, because if you need really good results, you will need human input. That's no question, in my opinion.
I think I want to just go back to Kendall's question, though. I thought what she was trying to get at was, when we try to sell, you know, the value of chatbots to a customer, we can tell them, you know, I mean, someone who's perhaps overzealous might tell them, oh yeah, you know, you can replace your entire service department by putting a chatbot, right? And that might be overstating the use case there. So I think, what is the sweet spot for selling customers on the value of chatbots? Is it something like that where you could just automate everything, or here's a set of flows that can be automated that make the most sense for chatbots in its current state of technology? I understand that it's an evolving technology base. Does that make sense, Peter?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, there are certain flows where you can use a chatbot better, let's say better than a real person. But it's very important to see, and this is what we also start like every customer conversation with that chatbots are not for replacing the actual human agents. It's not possible, so technically not feasible, and it wouldn't make any sense. So the goal of the chatbots are to, as you guys said, to automate certain tasks and make it more efficient for humans to handle these different tasks. For example, you have a customer care service, and let's say one agent have, for the sake of the example, the very same question asked of him like 20 times a day. So that's a very good candidate for a chatbot, because if those questions are not even the exact same, so not word by word the same, but similar enough, then our AI tools can recognize the correlation between them and answer in a meaningful way, actually. So for these scenarios, like we call these knowledge-based scenarios, when you have a lot of information and the user is trying to get the relevant pieces for his use case, that's a perfect case for a chatbot. But when you have a more complex situation, like let's say the user wants to create a new contract online, that's possible in some banks already or some insurance companies, that's obviously you cannot do with the chatbot. You need a human agent for that. And if they have a more complex question, that's also drawing a line. So this is how you can basically put these different use cases into different boxes. Is it something that happens a lot of the time? And are these occurrences similar to each other? Then it's a perfect candidate for automation. But it's always like making the work of the actual human agents more effective. Like, for example, we had a customer that was a very nice use case, in my opinion, for a chatbot. It was an insurance company. So you would be able to get a personalized portfolio of different insurance packages from the chatbot. So you would, as an end user, open the website, you would get the chat bubble, and the chatbot would ask you, okay, would you like to have a new insurance? Okay. You say, of course, and the chatbot would ask you a couple of questions like, how old are you? How many children do you have? Do you have a car? Et cetera, so questions like that. And after that, the chatbot would put together a personalized portfolio for you for like three or two different packages that would be relevant for you. And if you, as the end user, would say, okay, I'm interested in, let's say, the first option, then the chatbot would ask for your contact information like email address, phone number, time of the day when it would be appropriate for a live agent to reach out to you and finalize the details of the contract. And then it would say hello. And on the back end, it would create a new ticket in the CRM system of the customer. And the actual human agents would see the new ticket and they could reach out to the end users. So in my opinion, this was an absolutely perfect example of how you can enhance the workflow of your employees without replacing them. You see?
This actually sounds a lot. So I'm on the support side of the Azure world. And one of the things we always struggle with, and it sounds like it kind of matches the scenario you're talking about, is the customer opens up a case and they may say, hey, it's this subscription, but they may not tell us which VM or which virtual network or and that's information. It's repetitive, it's redundant. It's easy for the customer to get, but there's a flow to that, right? And so if we had something like that layered in front, which I have to confess we don't, right? We could get past some of that just Q&A before we get to the deeper technical, right? We're preserving the human being's time for the deeper technical conversation, just exactly. Like you're talking about with your customer. Now, that makes a lot of sense.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm interested, Peter, in maybe your experience with even like anti-patterns around building these things. Cause I think back to the days of like automated phone stuff, you know, menu systems where basically it would say, you know, press 1 to do this, 2 to do this. And then there was always this hidden thing of like, if you hit 0, you can always get to a live person. And I'm just wondering, is there like certain things where it's like, no, you should never do that in a chatbot because it's horribly inefficient or it breaks the whole model. Just in your experience, is there any of those kind of things that have popped up?
Mm-hmm. If I think about it really hard, I would say the worst possible thing, as I already mentioned, that you can do with a chatbot is that you make it act like a human, because the technology is simply not there. And sooner or later, the user will find out that they're not talking to a real person, and they will get absolutely angry, justified so, right? Because they are not getting the same experience as they would expect from a real human. But if you set the expectations right, so you upfront make it clear to the customer that they are talking to a chatbot, then you are starting from the same ground with the end user and your chatbot. And besides that, I can't really think about any anti-patterns. Basically, that's what I would say. Don't try to look smarter than you are. That's the anti-pattern.
That's a good one.
Hey, Peter.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question. So I've been hearing a lot about the enterprise template that just came out. Could you give us a little more details, more on like the development side of how the enterprise template is making development for chatbots a little different, and some of the new features that came with the enterprise template that's making a developer's life easier?
To be absolutely honest with you, I don't have any hands-on experience with that. So other than what you said, that it's a big package of reusable components, I cannot really say more than that. It's still so fresh, still so crispy that none of my customers so far using it. So I can't really give you any hands-on information about
Okay, what about just like bot development in general? Like how do you develop a bot?
Mm-hmm. Usually.
When you're working with bots?
Mm-hmm. Usually, I always give an example of one of my customers where we developed the chatbot from basically nothing to version 1.0 in 12 weeks. So to get from basically no chatbot to a real functioning chatbot with a couple of actual scenarios that can serve the customers, it was 12 weeks. And what is important to see is that more than half of that 12 weeks was about understanding the requirements of the user, which is of course not unheard of in any software development projects, to have a lot of discussion about what's possible, what not. But it's even more relevant in case of chatbots, because the customers usually either don't understand what is a chatbot or don't understand what is possible to achieve with a chatbot. So yeah, it was a lot of time for actually just making the plans how the chatbot should work, make the customer understand what is possible, what not. It took almost one third of the time than under just a couple of weeks. If I remember correctly, I don't want to tell you something that's not true, but really just 2 or 3 weeks, we developed the code. So the source code was done in a couple of weeks. I'm talking about the small chatbot, of course, but still very quickly. And the rest of the time was absolutely about training the different AI services. So like Louis, Q&A Maker, fine-tuning the different flows. We did a lot of A-B testing. So we put it up on the customer's website, but not every user could talk to the chatbot. Like every third or every fourth customer was able to see the chatbot at all. So we got a lot of customer feedback early on. And based on that, we improved even more the model. So it's in chatbot development, the least time that you spend with the code writing it, it's always about trying to understand your customers in the deepest level possible and fine-tuning all these different AI services to their needs. So this is how usually it looks like. It needs a lot of involvement from the customer, of course, all software development project does. But I would say that I am coming from a mobile developer world, so I know how mobile development works, and it's significantly more time that you need to spend on customer feedback, usage of your chatbot, even more than you would do with a mobile application.
How do you do error handling with chatbots? I suppose, you know, your users type in something and somehow they lose services, slow or whatever. Do you have like a fallback mechanism for how you can handle these? Like, I'm sure that might happen for a number of backend services.
It's really something that, as I see, everybody is trying to come up with their own solution. So most of the time, what is the most annoying and what you see in a lot of chatbots, they just say, sorry, I didn't understand, or sorry, some error happened. You know, that's the worst possible thing you can do, right?
Yep, that's what I asked.
Usually what we do is, for example, it's always like a chain of different components. So as I mentioned, most of the time we use Q&A Maker and Louis, and some custom logic that is expressed in the actual source code of the chatbot. And the most of the time, what you do, you go to Louis, let's say, try to understand what the user's intention is, what they want to achieve. And if Louis cannot give you a good enough suggestion about that, so they can decide if they were, for example, asking for ordering a pizza or checking the status of their previous order. So let's say Louis cannot decide that. Then you would go to the Q&A maker, which is a question and answers service. So maybe you just try, right? You try, okay, maybe the user asks something that is not even relevant for ordering pizza. And if you are failing on that, then you fall back to some default messages, or in some cases, that's the point when you hand over the chat to a real agent. That's, in my opinion, the most user-friendly way of handling this. So just hand it over to a real agent, and then they can, if the chatbot wasn't able to understand it, a real human 100% will be able to.
Awesome. That's very good. Thank you.
I'm interested, along with that, to follow on to what Sajit was talking about. And you mentioned, when I was asking the question about anti-patterns, about not trying to look too smart. But one of the things, at least just from the outside looking in at some of these bots, is, you know, you'd like to see feedback kind of immediately, maybe to Sajit's point. So if I type in something in a thing and I know I'm talking to a chatbot, if I don't see anything happen and then all of a sudden, like a minute later or 30 seconds later, something pops up, I might have like moved on. Is there like a pattern for like doing, just like when you're text messaging, you see dots or you see something thinking or 1 second or whatever like that? Is that a common pattern too, to give feedback immediately so that people know like, oh, there's something happening here? It's not just going into the ether somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. And it's exactly like you mentioned, is that you can send these small typing notifications that you would normally see when, for example, in Teams, when somebody types, you would see those three dots jumping around. You can send the very same thing from the chatbot. So let's say from the chatbot point of view, you get a message, you send this typing notification immediately before even trying to process the message. So telling the user, okay, I'm here, I'm doing something. And then you start to query these different services, because you just touched on a very, very important topic, is the delay. So it's incredibly important for your chatbot to be as performant as possible, because as you said, users get frustrated really quickly. And I was talking about just these two services, right? Louis and Q&A Maker. But as you improve your chatbot, these different services are kind of piling up on each other. So let's say, for example, I'm Hungarian. None of the services are basically, a couple of them, that's not true, not none of them, but a couple of them support Hungarian language, but most of them not, because we are a very small country. It makes sense. And in that case, you would need to, for example, use a Microsoft Translator before sending anything to any other cognitive services. That's another delay, which is basically a constant value that you need to live with, right? Because you have no other option. So you always need to balance between performance and, how to say it, smartness or intelligence of your chatbot. Because if the users don't wait for your chatbot to answer, it doesn't really matter how smart the answer was, right? If nobody sees that. So it's absolutely a challenge. And so Azure can help a lot with that. Sorry.
I have one final question for you. Curious, a lot of these, like, for example, Louis and Q&A Maker, I know the last time I was working in the bot space, were both in preview. So do you see that a lot of these services are getting flushed out and becoming enterprise ready? Or do you see just a lot more, you know, new features popping up that are in preview? Have a lot of these moved to where they're enterprise ready? Or is that at least in the pipeline?
It's, in my opinion, it's both. So it's like popping up new preview features, like I said, every week. It's hard to even keep up. And at the same time, the services that are proved to be the most popular, the most successful, the how to say, the best practices, the most must-have tools, they are becoming global availability, and they are transforming a lot. So, for example, as you said, Q&A Maker, that was just a web portal at the beginning in the preview days. And now it's a global availability service, and it gives you such a granular access to managing your solution is that when you register a Q&A Maker service, it's not just an access key that you get, but the actual infrastructure that is powering your Q&A Maker application is being deployed into your Azure subscription. I think it's a very, very smart idea because you actually see the consumption of your different services. You can scale up and down based on what the users are consuming. And it's just give you such a granular control over your service. And this is what I see with all of these cognitive services you just mentioned. Now you can deploy your cognitive services on premises or even on edge devices. So this is what I see. These are getting solidified and getting used in many, many places in many, many ways now.
Awesome. Well, Peter, this has been really a lot of information you've given us. I appreciate the time that you've spent with us, more than we originally planned on. Are there any final thoughts you want to leave with our listeners about how best they can get started with this? What, you know, like if someone like me, who's a total newbie when it comes to bots, you know, how can someone like me get into this space?
Two tips from me. So first is dev.botframework.com. That's the go-to place, obviously, to start looking at the documentation, use cases, best practices. So we have everything there. The documentation, in my personal opinion, is very good. It's being maintained very actively. And also, it's a very nice starting point to check the different GitHub repositories of the SDKs. And we have incredible amount of sample chatbot applications up on GitHub. The community is very welcoming. It's my personal experience. The developers of the SDK are very open to feedback. So it's a great company to be part of, even as a outsider from Microsoft. So I encourage everybody who is interested in chatbot development to hit up GitHub as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Any more final questions for Peter before we let him go? Okay. Well, Peter, thank you for kind of taking the time to come on. And this has been an excellent topic discussion that you've had. I think you're obviously an expert in this space, as is quite obvious from the way you clearly articulated some of the ways to go about doing chatbot development. So thank you for sharing your experience.
And thank you guys for having me. Thank you very much.
If you have any links that you want to share with us, I know you mentioned one already, but if you have any other tips, resources, et cetera, that you go to place, please send them to me and I'll add them along with the podcast on the website. Okay?
We'll do. Absolutely. Thank you guys again for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you and see you next time.